Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a new low in the theatre of the absurd that has become the trademark of the House Republicans on Capitol Hill as two hearings begin. One, the umpteenth investigation into Benghazi, and the other, even more farcical, a hearing chaired by global warming denier Congressman Lamar Smith of Texas, aimed at criticizing the Environmental Protection Agency's plan to curb global warming CO2 pollution from power plants. Norman Ornstein, who writes a weekly column for Roll Call, Congress Inside Out, and is the author with Thomas Mann of the recent bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, joins us to discuss how far the Republicans have gone off the rails since President Nixon founded the EPA and President Theodore Roosevelt established the Republican Party as the stewards of the environment. Then we'll look into a new study, Combat versus Climate, the Military and Climate Security Budgets, and speak with its co-author, Miriam Pemberton, a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the Peace Economy Transitions Project. We'll discuss the modest increase in the Pentagon's climate security budget from 1% in 2008 to 4% in 2013, which pales in comparison to China, which allocated nearly as much to climate change, $162 billion in 2013, as it did for its military forces, $188.5 billion. Then finally, we'll speak with James Bamford, the author of The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA, From 9/11 to Spying on America. He is an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues who writes for Wired magazine and spent 3 days in Moscow this summer with Edward Snowden, the fugitive former NSA contractor living in exile in Russia. We will discuss what Snowden told him about the activities of his former employer and James Bamford's article at the New York Times, Israel's NSA Scandal. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, who's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an election eve analyst for CBS News. Mr. Ornstein led a working group of scholars and practitioners that helped shape the law known as the McCain-Feingold that reformed the campaign financing system, and he was elected as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. His many books include The Permanent Campaign and Its Future, The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track, and most recently, the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, written with Thomas Mann. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And today, the U.S. House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology is holding a hearing to criticize the United States Environmental Protection Agency's, the EPA's, plan to curb climate-changing carbon pollution from power plants. The hearing is going to be chaired by Chairman Lamar Smith, Republican of Texas, who is on record denying the science of climate change. And added to this, of course, the House Republicans have voted 217 times against clean air, the environment, climate change policy, and clean energy. I'm reminded, Norm, that it was Republican President Richard M. Nixon who created the Environmental Protection Agency. So have the Republicans sort of gone off the rails in terms of the environment?
Of course, it's Richard Nixon. You could also take it back with this wonderful Ken Burns series on the Roosevelts. It was Teddy Roosevelt who pioneered the concept of conservation, got us the public lands. It was Republicans who were most closely identified with the environment, and now that's been turned completely on its head. Although I must tell you, Ian, I'm reminded of something on the Science Committee here. There is a member with the rather inept name Daniel Webster from Florida, a Republican from Florida, who has been trying for several years to eliminate the Census Bureau's annual community survey, which is viewed by local governments and businesses as absolutely essential to figuring out where to establish plants or businesses or where to put police for high crime areas and the like. And the argument that Daniel Webster, a member of the Science Committee, has made is, and I quote, "It's not a scientific survey, it's a random survey." So you can see that science doesn't seem to be attracting the people who know anything about science.
So what do you attribute this change to, this growth of anti-intellectualism that I think is universal, although it does seem that in terms of the representatives, perhaps there's more science deniers on the Republican side than on the Democratic side. But, you know, I have a theory, and for what it's worth, is that in many ways, I think John McCain opened the floodgates, if you will, with Sarah Palin, that she sort of, because she was suddenly catapulted to the possibility of even being president of the United States, at least being vice president, that sort of legitimized a kind of anti-intellectualism. I don't mean to beat up on her, but in many ways she does seem to be an exemplar of anti-intellectualism.
Well, I tweet now every once in a while. I got dragged into the technology a few months ago, and we just had this family-related brawl up in Alaska involving the family, in which Sarah Palin reportedly shouted out, "Do you know who I am?" And I tweeted, "Sarah Palin, do you know who I am? Me. Yes, so sadly, I do." But, you know, I believe that Palin was more a response to what had already been occurring in the party. And you're right, it's predominantly Republicans. It's not entirely. One of the things that's happened over the last 25 or 30 years is, as our politics have grown more tribal in nature, and the stakes have gotten high, and it goes to issues from defense all the way through the environment, scientists have been caught in the crosshairs, and people who want to push one side that doesn't seem to be supported by a substantial number of scientists go to discredit them. But it's taken on a much more dramatic coloration on the right now, and especially with what's happened with climate change. And now this tribal element, if you're for it, it must be evil, even if we were for it before, has really taken hold. And what Lamar Smith is doing now is reflecting, I think, a zeitgeist, especially in the activist wing of the Republican Party, that has major political figures almost unwilling to push against it. You perhaps saw that Bobby Jindal was interviewed in Washington a few days ago, and Howard Feynman, the great journalist, kept pushing him on whether he believed in evolution, on whether he believed in science. And the responses were almost laughable. Here's somebody who's no dummy, but who's trying to mount a presidential campaign, and it's become clear that you have to meet litmus tests that now diverge very, very sharply from any level of reality.
Again, I'm speaking with Norman Ornstein, who is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He writes the weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an election eve analyst for CBS News. Mr. Ornstein led a working group of scholars and practitioners that helped shape the law known as McCain-Feingold that reformed the campaign financing system, and he was elected as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and his many books include The Permanent Campaign and Its Future, The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track, and his latest, the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-written with Thomas Mann. Well, since you've touched on the idea of Republican presidential hopefuls, my understanding is, and we mentioned Richard Nixon a minute ago, that Mitt Romney is doing a Richard Nixon, that he's going around the country talking to all the local Republican parties, all the key people at the grassroots level, building the kind of comeback momentum that Richard Nixon did when he came out of the wilderness and came back into the presidency.
There's no doubt that he's been out there raising money and waving his flag. He denies that he would run again, but there are a lot of people out there pushing him to do so. It's kind of mind-boggling in a lot of ways, but it's clear that Republicans have softened their image of Romney to some degree, but also are just casting about for a candidate who doesn't appear on the surface to be a radical or a lunatic. Now, I'm very skeptical, and one thing we have to keep in mind is that Romney might have the image of being a moderate, but 4 years ago, when he was beginning his campaign to run against Barack Obama's reelection, with a party that was not as radical as today's, he moved to the right of virtually every other candidate. And on immigration, for example, he moved sharply to the right of Rick Perry, including his famous linchpin of an immigration policy, which was self-deportation. If this is what the party's looking for in terms of trying to move to the center, it's a very different center than the one we're used to.
But the field is all over the place, as you mentioned. There's some interesting characters. Most interesting of all, of course, is Rand Paul, who is really, I think, broadening his outreach to every voter in the country, which is something that Republicans haven't done for a long time. He's going after students. He's going on campuses a lot. He's going after Silicon Valley. He did some charitable work down in Guatemala to sort of bolster his humanitarian credentials. I think he's quite a formidable force. And he may have people like John McCain and the sort of internationalists and interventionists upset. And he has, of course, moderated his position on the Islamic State after having criticized Hillary Clinton as a war hawk. What do you make of him?
He's the most interesting figure in many ways in national politics right now because of the amalgam that he represents. And as you pointed out, he is for re-enfranchisement of felons. He has spoken out against police militarization. He is an ardent opponent of the kind of big data collection and use of it by NSA. And that has some appeal to both younger voters and some minorities. At the same time, his budget plans would basically make Paul Ryan's budget look like the New Deal. He is... it's not at all clear where he's going on national security. He's calibrating a bit. And we also have to keep in mind that for a long time, his close advisor, who co-wrote a book with him, was basically a segregationist who celebrated the pre-Civil War South. So he's got baggage that will make it more difficult as he gets more visibility. But Paul is not like his father, who was more rigid in his libertarian beliefs. He's a little bit more flexible to try to reach out to different audiences, and he may have some success out there. I must tell you frankly, it wouldn't surprise me at all if you have a Republican nomination contest that comes down to Rand Paul and Ted Cruz. And at that point, Paul, who is viewed with enormous distrust by the not just the McCain wing of the party, but by a lot of his colleagues, would become the candidate of the establishment against Cruz, who's despised by virtually everybody else in the party hierarchy.
But running against Hillary Clinton, it would be very interesting, wouldn't it, having Rand Paul?
It's hard to imagine a more interesting presidential contest than that one.
So just to return a little bit to the, I took us on a diversion there, Norman Ornstein, back to the kind of Capitol Hill follies going on at the moment. Representative Trey Gowdy, the Republican of South Carolina, former federal prosecutor, is the chairman of a committee now looking into Benghazi for the umpteenth time. He's went to great lengths to suggest that there was something new about this hearing. What's your sense of what they're doing in terms of the strategy to sort of muddy the waters vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton? Is that going to work?
I'm very skeptical that it's going to work for a couple of reasons. One is we had the Armed Services Committee report, a bipartisan report from the Senate, that basically made it clear that all of these dire statements about a Benghazi cover-up, you know, these deep-seated failures that go right back to the White House were pretty much nonsensical. There seems to be nothing there other than what is clearly an effort by some of the CIA people on site in Benghazi to try and keep from having it publicized that they had a big CIA listening post there, but nothing else other than a great tragedy. The second part of this is, and you can look at a very interesting piece written by a longtime congressional staffer with the Center for American Progress, Scott Lilly, that basically said, if you look at the number of diplomatic personnel killed over the years in embassies and consulates abroad through terrorist attacks or the like, there were dozens of them. If you look at the coverage of them, none of them had anything close to what happened in Benghazi, which is one of many, many. So I think all of this is a transparent attempt to try and make a big scandal out of something that is a failure of administration in some ways, a failure of judgment by many people, including our ambassador there and going to a place that was questionable, and including some serious missteps on the ground in the fog of conflict. But I just don't think many Americans, other than the most ardent anti-Clinton true believers, are going to pay much attention to it. And I also think it has a chance of backfiring on a Congress that is not doing anything to get the economy moving, not doing anything to deal with stagnant wages, not doing anything to deal with the problem of climate change, not dealing with infrastructure, trying to improve the rollout of a major health care plan, but instead it's all Benghazi and all IRS all the time.
One of the tragedies, of course, about the latter that you just mentioned, the infrastructure, given the underinvestment and the sorry state of so much of the infrastructure, bridges and roads and railways, etc., is that I spoke recently to some professors at the Harvard Business School who have done do an annual survey with their alumni about the economy. And of course, Harvard Business School alumni, quite a number of them are fairly in Fortune 500 companies at higher levels. They were all basically saying that this is crazy, that we're not doing anything about infrastructure. We have never had a better moment with interest rates being as low as they have to make these investments. We have underemployment in the construction sector. It's a win-win. But go figure.
And again, should not be a partisan issue. And you have a bill to create an infrastructure bank, a public-private partnership, funded in part by repatriating some of those massive corporate profits that are abroad. John Delaney of Maryland, a Democrat, business-oriented guy, joining with some conservative Republicans, and the leaders have no interest in bringing it up, even though it would clearly have a very positive effect on the economy, and even though the business community is ardently for it. And that just tells you an awful lot about how dysfunctional we are.
But is that also to tell us that this current sort of Republican Party, that sort of, if it's not dominated by the Tea Party, it's certainly intimidated by them, has it fallen out of step with American businessmen, the traditional kind of Chamber of Commerce wing of the Republican Party?
I think the big business community is at its lowest point in terms of clout in Washington and in Congress in many decades, and it's in part because the Chamber of Commerce made a bet. They basically bet on Republican majorities, helped to elect many of the Tea Party individuals who have nothing but disdain for them, and their agenda just doesn't matter very much to a lot of people who at this point want more than anything else to avoid some kind of a signing ceremony where it might look like Barack Obama is actually doing something, and especially doing something in a bipartisan way.
Well, just in closing then, just to return to the original theme of what's going on Capitol Hill, this hearing, the umpteenth hearing on Benghazi, chaired by Representative Trey Gowdy of South Carolina, do you think that at the end of the day, they're actually going to help Hillary Clinton? Because I've talked to a lot of former Special Forces people and CIA people to try and get to the bottom of what happened. There's certainly some questions about why the ambassador was there in the first place. It may have had to do with more personal things. So they're sort of exploiting something that nobody really wants to talk about. But in terms of the actual incident themselves, this new book that's coming out, 13 Hours, the inside account of what really happened in Benghazi, by five of these Delta Force members in this, who were contracted by the CIA to guard this secret annex that the CIA, as you pointed out, didn't want to publicize its existence. The main complaint that they have is that they are ready to go and rescue the ambassador, but were stood down by the CIA station chief, who, by the way, was in Tripoli, the capital. So what I hear is that, you know, that there was excessive caution because there was this sense, whether it came from Hillary Clinton directly or whether it was in the kind of groupthink, that, you know, Libya was a success. Obama was sort of pushed into it by Hillary and Rice and Samantha Power against the wishes of Bob Gates and the Joint Chiefs, and that they basically wanted to sort of paint it as a great success. And that's why there was a kind of low-key lack of protection, because there was a kind of political groupthink that we did a great thing, we got rid of Gaddafi and everything's fine, when in fact, as we know today, the place is in absolute chaos.
There's no doubt it's in chaos, but I don't think that's the reason that we didn't have adequate security there. It was Benghazi itself was clearly not the most stable place, even in Libya. But I think there's another element of this that we have to keep in mind, which is that the budgets for embassy security in this era have been cut very substantially. And that meant some excruciating choices that had to be made by the State Department at levels way below those of the secretary. It's not clear they made all the best decisions. Some of them were kind of bizarre, given the threat levels in different places. But that had something to do with it as well. And I think, you know, if there is an effort here to tie this tragedy to Clinton, I'm very skeptical that it will work or have any level of success. And I do believe that the emphasis on this, not just in the Republican Congress, but on Fox News and other places, story after story, day after day, hour after hour, is much more a reflection of the belief that Clinton is an overwhelming favorite to win a Democratic nomination and would be a strong favorite to win the White House. And this is a potent attack line, but I'm skeptical.
Well,
and
but just Ian, I know you have to go.
I've got to run. I agree.
Well, let me just close out then. And frankly, what you just told us in terms of budget cuts, clearly they were done by the Republican Congress in any case. Yeah. I thank you for joining us, Norman Ornstein.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an Election Eve analyst for CBS News. Mr. Ornstein led a working group of scholars and practitioners that helped shape the law known as the McCain-Feingold that reformed the campaign financing system. He was elected as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and his many books include The Permanent Campaign and Its Future, The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America, and How to Get It Back on Track. His latest New York Times bestseller is It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-written with Thomas Mann. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into a new study, Combat versus Climate, the Military and Climate Security Budgets.
Down by the riverside, down by the...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Miriam Pemberton, who is a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the Peace Economy Transition Project, which focuses on helping to build the foundations of a post-war economy at the federal, state, and local levels. She is the co-author of a new report at the Institute for Policy Studies, Combat versus Climate, The Military and Climate Security Budgets Compared. Welcome to Background Briefing, Miriam Pemberton.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And according to this new report that comes out on Thursday, you're comparing trends in U.S. spending on military with spending on climate security, and it finds that there's been a minor improvement in the proportion of U.S. spending on climate change from the military, from 1% in 2008 to 4% in 2013. And I take it the point is that you're comparing it to the nearest peer competitor, which is China. And just as a contrast, in 2013, China allocated nearly half as much to climate change, $162 billion, as to its military forces, $188.5 billion. So obviously there's a major disparity there, right, between the U.S. and China.
Yes, I'm obviously not saying that China has an exemplary environmental record. It's now overtaken the U.S. as the most prodigious creator of greenhouse gases on the planet. However, it is also investing massively in renewables, specifically in solar energy. It's, as your figures suggest, it is investing in this sector far more than the United States. These figures are, you know, to distinguish what the Chinese government is spending from what Chinese industry is doing is not, it's not a clear division, because the Chinese government is so involved in supporting its industries. But that's part of the point, that the Chinese government is investing and creating these industries, and the U.S. currently is not.
Well, one of the things that I thought was going on with the Pentagon was a realization that we've had all these wars in the Middle East that have cost trillions of dollars, the Iraq War and the Afghan War, and now we're going to have Iraq War III, and that for the longest time the military have figured out that this is not exactly the way to have a sustainable military if you are dependent upon fossil fuels largely coming from the Persian Gulf, an area of instability that we continually get drawn back into, and that if the American military were energy self-sufficient, and if the American people were energy self-sufficient, then we wouldn't be at the mercy of foreign oil. And there's been this mantra forever, ever, that I've heard for the last decades or so, we've got to get off foreign oil. So what happened to that idea in terms of, you know, just from a purely military point of view?
Well, actually, we have, we are more energy independent than we were, but we are focusing mainly on natural gas, which is, it's not as dirty a fossil fuel as coal, which is where most of our power comes from. But what we need to be doing is investing massively in actual clean energy, which is renewable sources, solar and wind. The U.S. military is actually putting some investments in converting its own operations to using more clean energy sources, but it massively outspends those amounts by what it spends on fossil fuels. It's still very fossil fuel dependent.
Well, but there was a hope with particularly entrepreneurs in alternative energy that the military, with all of its money, it could be an incubator for new technology. And I remember reading some time back that the Navy were wanting to invest in different forms of even energy produced by algae. Obviously, they're a huge consumer of fossil fuels. They were even talking about planes that would fly on liquid hydrogen. It seems like they're thinking about it, if not investing in it. And I thought that that was one of the hopes, but I've also understood that the oil lobby has fought against it on Capitol Hill. And we just got through talking with Norman Ornstein about the follies on Capitol Hill today, where you have this farcical hearing chaired by Representative Lamar Smith of Texas, who is a global warming denier, looking into the Environmental Protection Agency's plan to curb global warming gases from power plants. I mean, talk about Dracula in charge of the blood bank here.
And some Republican lawmakers are saying, are looking at the military's budget for clean energy for itself and saying, enough of that. You know, we need to be focusing on building more tanks and more more planes and more weapons platforms. So even this very modest budget compared to the overall budget, it's about $2.3 billion that the military is spending or spent in 2013 on clean energy initiatives. And that is obviously dwarfed by what they're spending on traditional instruments of military force. But even that is too much for some of these Republican lawmakers that are trying to just completely eliminate that budget from the military's budget.
So what do you think it's going to take? I mean, I recall some time back meeting with a group of CIA officers who had just come back from Australia, where they had a big conference on future threats, on transnational threats in particular. And the consensus was that the greatest threat in the future was climate change. And these CIA guys were telling me that they were surprised at how much the Australian intelligence people were way ahead of them in recognizing climate change as a strategic and national security threat. And Australia is one of the most impacted countries in the world by climate change. It's getting so bad now that the kangaroos in the middle of the country simply can't stand the heat. And yet they have a prime minister in Australia who was recently elected who's a global warming denier. So, I mean, it seems like we make one step forward and 10 step backwards.
So the CIA, you mentioned, set up an environmental unit to look at the threat of climate change back in 1998. So, you know, this has been on the radar screen, and it's now much more central in the national security strategy of the United States. This is a major security threat. But what the military is not saying is what we are saying in this report, which is, you know, if that's the case, we need to be shifting resources from the budgets for these traditional instruments of military force toward, toward preventing the emergence of this major security threat. And that's, the military is not advocating for that. In fact, it's pretty clear that they're starting to use the threat of climate change as a reason to increase military spending. So, for example, the Navy is talking about, you know, this new Arctic Ocean that's going to be opened up. They're not saying, let's invest in reducing global emissions so that we can try to prevent this new ocean from enlarging. Rather, you know, they're saying, therefore, we're going to be needing a lot more ships to patrol this new ocean. So, we're saying if climate change is the massive security threat that the military says it is, then we ought to be considering that in the overall balance of what we spend on traditional military instruments as opposed to climate change. So it's basically a question of investing in an ounce of prevention to obviate the need for a pound of military cure.
And indeed, we've got a long way to go to catch up to China, where they're investing almost as much in climate change as they are in military force. I thank you for joining us, Miriam Pemberton.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Miriam Pemberton, who's a research fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she directs the Peace Economy Transitions Project, which focuses on helping to build the foundations of a post-war economy at the federal, state, and local levels. She is the co-author of a new report at the Institute for Policy Studies, Combat versus Climate, The Military and Climate Security Budgets Compared. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with James Bamford, who spent 3 days in Moscow in the summer with the fugitive NSA contractor Edward Snowden. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Bamford, who's an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was the Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. He currently writes for Wired magazine and has an op-ed at the New York Times, Israel's NSA Scandal. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Bamford.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
So, James, you had the unusual opportunity to spend 3 days with Edward Snowden in Moscow. You were in Moscow this summer reporting a story for Wired magazine. And so give us a sense of how you were able to pull off that scoop, I guess. And, you know, just give me a sense of what took place, how it was arranged, and what it was like hanging out for 3 days with this very obviously incendiary character in terms of U.S.-Russian relations.
Well, it took quite a while. It took about 9 months to sort of arrange. I met with a number of people who knew him, like Glenn Greenwald in Rio and Laura Poitras in Berlin. And I dealt quite a bit with Ed Snowden's lawyer in New York. So it took quite a bit of effort to actually get to him. And then once I was able to fly over there, I still wasn't able to find out exactly when and where and how we were going to meet in Moscow. And then after about a day or so, I got a encrypted message on my computer. I'd only taken a computer that was it was basically a virgin computer. It was a computer I'd never used before. And all I had on there was an encryption package, and then I got an encrypted message from one of his contacts saying he'd meet me at a particular hotel and I should have a book. I'll be reading a book, and then he'll approach me. So it was a little bit clandestine, but it was worked out very well.
So how did he seem to you in terms of his physical and mental state?
Well, very good. I describe him in my Wired article sort of like a first-year graduate student. I mean, he doesn't have a lot of demands in terms of living expenses. His he lives fairly modestly, and Moscow is a very interesting place to live these days. It's not quite like people picture the old Moscow under Khrushchev or whatever. They had a rock concert going on in Red Square while I was there. And, you know, it's a very livable city. So I think he's getting along fairly well. He lives, at least his place, I think, where he lives basically is in an area that's, there's not a lot of Americans, so he doesn't have too much of a chance of being recognized. He's recognized occasionally by Russians when he goes into a computer store, and he sort of puts his finger in front of his mouth and asks them to be quiet, not say anything about it. And he shops at a local grocery store, and nobody recognizes him. So he lives a fairly normal life over there, despite the fact that he's probably the most wanted person in the world in terms of the United States.
And given that the new Moscow that you're talking about is incredibly expensive, I mean, it also has the division between the rich and the poor in Russia, of course, mirrors that of the United States. How does he get by? Where does he get his funds from?
Well, I think he had a very high-paying job when he was in the U.S. He was making over $100,000 a year. He didn't have a lot of high living expenses, so I think he had a fair amount of savings. In addition to that, I think he gets probably some money for speaking when he speaks, like on these big jumbotrons, possibly. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a opportunity for him to work for some kind of a foundation where they will develop or have him do research on developing an encrypted method of communicating with sources and so forth, or having a way for a source to contact a journalist without having the metadata show up. So I think there's a number of possibilities, but he just got an extension of 3 years on his asylum in Moscow, so he's got a fair amount of time to work on something like that.
Well, he was offered a job by VKontakte, the Russian equivalent of Facebook. I don't know whether it's a serious offer or not, but of course, subsequently to that, the founder of VKontakte was pretty much forced out of the company that he formed, and a crony of Putin's at the Kremlin has taken over. So I guess that didn't materialize.
I don't think so. I think I think the most likely possibility would be this sort of foundation. I think it's based in South Africa, someplace like that. And it sounds fairly very innocent. I mean, he's just not working for the Russian government or anything. He'd be working for a private foundation that specializes in trying to help journalists. So I think that's the way it's going, but I don't have any knowledge as to whether he's actually assumed that role or not.
Again, I'm speaking with James Bamford, who's an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was the Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight, and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. And he currently writes for Wired magazine and has an op-ed at the New York Times, Israel's NSA Scandal. So let's turn to the article that you wrote for the New York Times. And I take it that the most shocking discovery from your conversations in Moscow, hanging out with Edward Snowden for 3 days, was his revelation about how the United States, the NSA, is sending raw intelligence. These are private communications of Americans directly to Israel military intelligence organization known as Unit 8200. So just walk us through what he told you.
Well, he spent 3 days with him. That's the longest anybody has spent with him in Moscow so far. He told me a number of things, so that was one of them. And what he said was that he was rather shocked at the fact that the U.S. was taking a lot of the information it collects, including a lot of domestic information, not most of it, and shipping it off to Israel without any sort of redactions or deletions of personal names, personal information from Americans. Because even with countries like England, you have to, which are very close to the United States and part of the NSA Five Eyes partnership, they always delete the names and personally identifying information of Americans, but they didn't do that for Israel. So he was rather shocked about that. And then I discovered last week that there were 43 members of that organization, the Israeli NSA organization called Unit 8200, who basically walked off the job and wrote a letter to the prime minister saying that they won't take part in doing this immoral activity anymore. It was full of abuses, taking information about people's sexual preferences, illnesses, whether they're having an affair or not, and then using that against these Palestinians to try to turn them into informants. So these 43 members of this Israeli NSA said they weren't going to do it anymore and refused to continue to take part in the organization's activities. So that was rather shocking. And then when you put it together with the fact that a lot of that information that's going to Israel, that a lot of that information is going through and looking for these sexual preferences and other personal information is coming unfiltered from the United States. It's a fairly shocking discovery when I found that out.
So specifically, the NSA in this trolling of the metadata that they do, they would send to the Israelis, apparently being asked by the Israelis and tasked for this specific information. This information would be largely on what, Arab Americans, Palestinian Americans, their conversations, or would it involve members of the U.S. press covering, as I do, the Middle East?
I think it's a great deal of information. It didn't seem like it was restricted very much. It seemed like it was passed in bulk, so I think it would include all of those categories. I think it would include anybody who NSA happens to be picking up. They didn't seem to have, according to both Ed Snowden and also one of the documents he leaked out that I read, it said that they were giving virtually unhindered access to Israel of U.S. intercepts. So it didn't seem like it was very limited at all.
But was it specific? Was it targeted? In other words, how do you sort out from the millions and millions of phone conversations of Americans about all kinds of subjects to those that would interest the Israelis?
I'm not sure. In terms of the actual mechanics, it didn't describe that. It just mentioned that it was sending Israel in bulk this intercepted communications, and that there were no restrictions on it in terms of, or there were no deletions on it in terms of personal information, names, and other types of personal information. It also said that the Israelis were supposed to respect American laws on this. However, there is nothing to enforce them to do it. And what the whistleblowers from the Israeli NSA said was that there was almost no supervision of this information, this kind of information that they were going through. So if you don't put any restrictions on them, you give them the full personal information about Americans, and there's very little, if no supervision of their activities, that's what happens. They start using it for exploiting sexual orientations, infidelities, money problems, family medical conditions, and then using that as leverage, blackmail basically, to coerce Palestinians into becoming collaborators.
So the NSA apparently has been sending this bulk intelligence that is raw, it's not redacted in any way, to Israel since at least March of 2009, and apparently the agreement, and this memo apparently of the agreement, is the one that you mentioned that you had seen from General Alexander, the then director of the NSA, saying that the memo emphasizes that Israel should make use of the intercepts in accordance with the United States law, but also notes that the agreement is legally unenforceable. So that's that's a bit of a catch-22, wouldn't you say?
Well, sure, it's legally unenforceable. And then with the veterans of Unit 8200, the whistleblowers there were saying is that there's no supervision anyway. So it really makes no difference whether the U.S. is saying, please treat this as under U.S. law when there's no enforcement and that there's no supervision anyway.
Well, but to my question earlier, Jim, about what are the categories, what are the NSA targeting and what are the Israelis asking for, My understanding from your article is that they want to use this information to damage the reputation of people who both, I imagine, the NSA and the Israelis consider radicalizers. Now, that's a category I've never heard before. You're not talking about terrorists. You're talking about radicalizers, which are what? People that influence terrorists?
Yeah, it's actually two things. The memo, there are two memos there. One of the memos dealt with the agreement between the United States and Israel, and then there was a separate memo that I quote from, and that was an internal NSA top secret memo that where director of NSA Keith Alexander writes that the NSA he basically writes that we're collecting information on people's visits to porn sites and other things like that that show people's vulnerabilities, and that we should use these vulnerabilities against them. And the people that he was specifically discussing targeting were people he called radicalizers. They weren't terrorists. They weren't criminals. They were people who basically would use fiery language or whatever to help radicalize others. So that's basically what the focus was on in terms of the U.S. And what the worry that I mentioned in the article, is that the U.S. would be going the way of the Israelis, and that this memo here was a step along that road, because the director of NSA is proposing using visits to porn sites, which the NSA collects, according to the memo, and then using that against people they don't like, people they consider radicalizers. And when I was in Moscow, I was discussing this with Ed Snowden. He said that he basically compared it to the FBI activity back in the 1960s when they were using sexual indiscretions to try to undermine radicals back then. And among those radicals was Dr. Martin Luther King, for example. And they were trying to create enormous divisions within his community. And to some degree, they exceeded. They succeeded in that. So that was the worry, is that the NSA was heading in the same direction of using this these vulnerabilities, these visits to porn sites, sexual orientation, infidelities, and so forth, and then using them against people that were speaking radically against the government.
Well, I just frankly, I don't see the connection between visiting porn sites and being radical and anti-government, whether you're anti-U.S. government or anti-anybody's government. I mean, it's a strange connection, you know, particularly if you're talking about, say, you know, members of the Islamic State who seem to be zealous and pious. I know that when they captured all of that stuff from bin Laden's place in Pakistan, they say that he was watching porn, but you don't know whether that's deliberate disinformation or not. But it's an odd connection, don't you think? I understand the old tradition in intelligence of the so-called honey trap, but you would think that, particularly in terms of radical Islam, that I don't think, for example, al-Waqi, the guy that they got in Yemen, probably watched porn. He was they're very religious people, aren't they, quite often, these radicals?
Oh, they are, yeah. But they're human beings also, so they occasionally watch porn. So they talked about a number of what I saw was an unredacted copy of this memorandum, and it actually listed the names of the people that they were suggesting that they do this to. And it mentioned that several of them had visited porn sites and that they were talking about using that as leverage against them, to try to use that to discredit them in front of their followers. In other words, if they were supposed to be devout Muslims and then they leaked it to the press or got it out somehow, that to his followers that this person was watching porn, whatever, or had an infidelity or whatever, that would discredit him and destroy his credibility within his organization. Again, this is what the memo indicated, and so I agree. I think the whole thing is absurd, but this is the way the NSA was going.
In other words, this is your tax dollars at work.
That's right, yeah. I just think of about a million better ways to spend it, but this is what happens when an agency gets far more money than it needs and tries to find new ways of spending it.
Well, James Bamford, just in closing, anything else that you recall from your meeting with Ed Snowden in Moscow, having spent 3 days with him, which is more than anybody has, unusual opportunity that you had? What was the one thing that you came away with?
Well, a couple of the things that were, I thought, were really important. One of them was that he had never before said that he had actually left sort of digital breadcrumbs when he was taking these documents. In other words, the government says he took $1.7 million. Well, what he says is that's probably how many he looked at, but that's not how many he took. And he deliberately left indications on the documents that they took. He took copies of them. And on the originals, he left some digital indications indicating which ones he actually took. And he was very surprised that the NSA wasn't able to determine or pick up on those clues and find out which ones he actually took as opposed to which ones he actually looked at. And he also mentioned in his last job as being a cyber warrior that he was very shocked at the fact that the NSA was developing a program called Monster Mind. And what the program did was a program they were discussing putting into effect. And what it did was when a piece of malware would come into the United States, instead of just stopping it, which is what the government normally does, it would automatically fire a piece of malware back to where it came from. And he said that the problem is a lot of times where it comes from is not where it was actually sent from, because they could send it through a number of different proxies. And so the problem with that is that a piece of malware comes in and there's a system that just automatically fires back malware, and you may end up shutting down a hospital in Moscow or someplace when it was actually something sent from North Korea. So he was very shocked that the government was pushing all this automation and cyber warfare.
Sort of electronic hair trigger, really.
Exactly, yeah. Without completely taking a human being out of the equation to try to judge whether this is a legitimate target or not, and just automatically firing back at wherever this came from. And there's a very good chance of accidentally starting a war that way if you're firing at a country and particularly a sensitive place, an electrical grid or whatever it is you're firing back on it. That is a mistake or something that was never fired at you in the first place.
Well, James Bamford, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with James Bamford, who's an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was the Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. He currently writes for Wired magazine and has an op-ed at the New York Times, Israel's NSA Scandal. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.